Oh, hello. Are we back on air?
Yeah, well, I am.
Oh, that was a quick break.
We're on air?
Ah, yes, that's a quick break. Welcome back, everyone. Were you talking there for a few seconds?
No, I didn't. It was just silent, so I just didn't know what happened because my Skype screen's gone weird. Is my normal picture up the way you receive it?
Yes, it is.
Oh, good, because it's an absolutely bad one.
Welcome back, everyone. That was a very quick break. I thought it might have been a little longer. I needed a nature break there, but we're back for the third and final hour. Jill, you want to introduce our next guest? You're partly responsible for getting him back on.
Oh, yes, I'd love to. Look, we have a wonderful person who's very passionate, sought-after speaker, who frequently presents for domestic violence, government and educational professional groups.
Hang on a second, Jill.
Ex-attorney, yep.
I need to say, everyone, welcome to the show once again, Jill Trebilcock, one of my bestest friends from Australia that I've never met.
Well, I don't know. A meeting of the minds. We've met on, I don't know about this never met business, but yes, it's true.
But go ahead and continue.
We've met on Skype, and it seems like it's a real meeting by now. I've watched Stephen lose a lot of weight. I've seen a lot of things happening with Stephen and stack a lot on and then lose it. Anyway, today, another person who we haven't met but we have met is Barry Goldstein, who's a nationally recognized domestic violence author and speaker. And he is an advocate, and he's written some of the leading books on domestic violence and custody, including Domestic Violence, Abuse and Child Custody, co-edited with Dr. Mo Therese Hannah, representing the domestic violence survivor. And he co-authored, I'm a bit confused about that. I think I might let you explain that. But anyway, his latest book, the newest book that Barry Goldstein has written, is his attempt to get the country of America interested in doing something more about domestic violence, because there doesn't seem to be a lot of motivation to help people with domestic violence. And so his book's called The Quincy Solution, Stop Domestic Violence and Save $500 Billion. So he thinks that if we stop domestic violence, I don't know how, we'll see if Barry's got some ideas on this, we can dramatically reduce violence and crime with some of these proven methods. So welcome, Barry Goldstein.
Hi, Julian. Good to speak with you.
Yeah, welcome back, I should say. Good to speak with you again. So your book is due to be launched soon.
Yeah, this Wednesday. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, fabulous. Look, what motivated you to write the book, Barry?
Well, what happened was I started writing a chapter for my next book with Dr. Hannah, in which I was comparing the successful practices in Quincy, Massachusetts, which led to a dramatic reduction in domestic violence crime, with the failed practices in Poughkeepsie, New York, which resulted in 9 deaths within 1 year in a small county. And in the course of writing it, it didn't surprise me that we knew how to dramatically reduce domestic violence. But I found out that rather than have to spend money for this wonderful outcome, we would actually save a lot of money. And this is based on the ACE research, which is Adverse Childhood Experiences, which demonstrates that in the United States, we are spending $750 billion a year on healthcare costs related to domestic violence. Now, the Quincy solution can be adopted in any country. The healthcare savings are probably less because most of you have a much better system than we do. But it would still be substantial money that would benefit everybody.
Okay, so what it seems to me that you're saying is that the after effects of domestic violence are very costly to the nation. Is that the implication there?
Yes. I mean, what the ACE research is really saying is that previously, when we looked at the cost of health care related to domestic violence, all we looked at was how to treat the immediate wounds. Mm-hmm. But far more damaging is the long-term effects. That the whole purpose of domestic violence is to scare and intimidate the partner, which in turn scares and intimidates the children. Mm-hmm. And that fear tactic creates an enormous amount of stress. Now, it's not surprising that stress is related to a lot of common diseases like heart disease, like cancer, like diabetes. What it also, the stress also releases pro-inflammatories, which cause more problems. It undermines our immune systems. So for many reasons, tolerating domestic violence and child abuse creates enormous long-term health risks. And we had never looked at that aspect of it because we were only thinking of the immediate assault. And, you know, as you know, we tend, when we talk about domestic violence, to think mostly of physical abuse, while most domestic violence are other tactics that are not either physical or illegal.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense because, well, you even take it, you could, I mean, one can even take that into intergenerational abuse.
Yeah, that's part of it, that children who witness domestic violence are more likely to repeat that, or at least boys are more likely to abuse their partners. Girls are more likely to be abused by their partners. And so it makes it go from generation to generation. And that's certainly something we'd like to change.
Yeah, that's, I think that's really important. And, so you're saying, so, you know, as governments are very much sort of, well, you know, as Stephen says, follow the money. As governments are so sort of tied into the financial aspect, you thought you'd explain it that way. That's a question.
We're really excited about it because, you know, public officials have not been as supportive as they should be of ending domestic violence. And we think the huge financial savings, not only from healthcare costs, but reduction in crime and the fact that victims, children, and even abusers will reach their economic potential, which is going to improve the economy in addition to the human benefits. So there are huge incentives for adopting the Quincy solution. And what we need to do and what we are doing is creating a campaign to adopt the Quincy solution to gain all these benefits. And hopefully your listeners will want to be part of that campaign.
Right. And the Quincy solution, what was the Quincy solution that you're using as a model, or, you know, why the title of the book, The Quincy Solution? What is the Quincy solution?
Well, the original practices developed in Quincy basically had about five major components. It involved strict enforcement of criminal laws, orders of protection, probation requirements, practices that made it easier for victims to leave, and a coordinated community response. And those practices in Quincy led to a county that had averaged 5 to 6 DV homicides a year, enjoying several years with no homicides. Then they had one, and then they were back to none. I have added a few things because the Quincy solution occurred, or at least the Quincy model occurred, between the late 70s and the mid-90s. So things have happened since. So I've added the new research that can really help make this more effective, new technology like, for instance, GPS to monitor abusers. And most important is we've included the custody courts. The prosecutor in Quincy noticed that victims stopped cooperating when the abuser went after custody. And this did not derail Quincy because at that time it was a rare response. Today it is a standard abuser tactic, not only in the U.S., but in many other countries, for abusers to seek custody as a way of regaining control over their victims. And unfortunately, The court system is broken. They're so anxious to include even the most dangerous fathers that they don't know how to recognize domestic violence, and they keep making decisions that undermine the work to end domestic violence and send children to live with dangerous abusers. And that has been a disaster. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things that led to a number of the murders in Poughkeepsie, which had a particularly bad response to domestic violence custody cases. So one of the ways that we're doing, including the custody courts, is the Safe Child Act, which says something pretty obvious, which is that when you decide custody and visitation, the first priority must be the health and safety of children. And when we've talked to legislators and others, that's something they can support because, you know, custody is a very controversial issue, but to say that let's focus on the health and safety of children, that's not controversial. That's just common sense.
Yeah. Say, Barry, don't they already have legislation and laws on the books about safe child acts or anything?
Well, what in every state in this country, and I think it's similar in other countries, they have a standard is the best interest of children, and they have a number of factors that the judge has discretion of what to focus on. So I once had a case in Rockland County, New York, where the father made a big deal that the mother was dressing the two sisters who were about a year apart the same as if they were twins, and they made that out to be some horrible psychological problem. When the judge met with the girls, they told him that they had seen their father take a knife to their mother's throat, which, you know, anyone with common sense would know is a far more serious issue. But the judge focused on how the girls were dressed and gave custody to the father that took the knife to the mother's throat. So what happens now is that the courts are using unqualified professionals, and the Safe Child Act would require that they use genuine experts and that they focus on the issues that are most impactful to the children. And we think that would be helpful. There aren't any states that have the Safe Child Act per se. Colorado passed a law that seeks to make safety the first issue. And it's pretty new, so we don't know exactly how it's working. But I did have a chance to speak with a judge from Colorado. And one of the things he said was that it resulted in judges having more interest in getting training. And that's one of the things we're hoping to do, that by passing a new law that says courts have to handle this differently, it might get judges and other professionals to look at the new research. Because right now there's a tendency for judges and other professionals who get a couple of hours of training and think they understand DV, and so they don't look to the research and they don't look to the genuine experts, and they keep putting children in jeopardy.
Well, this label best interest, the best interest principle seems to be a worldwide sort of label within social services. And the definition of best interest is, people don't understand, it's a capital B, a capital I. Best interest
is actually policy. They're skewing it, Jill. They're skewing the line of, between good and bad as far as taking care of a child.
Go on, Barry.
I think that one of the big problems is that court professionals have been told over and over again that children need both parents equally. And it's a lie. Children need their primary attachment figure more than the other parent. They need the safe parent more than the abusive one. But because the courts have just blindly focused on that, then what they're trying to do is ask the victim to forget about the past abuse and just cooperate with the abuser, instead of requiring the abuser to stop his abuse if he wants a relationship with the children. And I think that's a big reason why the courts get so many of these cases wrong.
Okay, so when you're talking about asking the abuser to stop abusing the children, I'm quite sure they've been asked that many times. How do you factor this in with a realistic outcome, Barry? What sort of processes do you have in mind?
Well, the only things that have been shown to change abusers' behavior is accountability and monitoring.
Yep.
And so, you know, the proper outcome in a typical domestic violence case would be for the safe parent to get custody and for the abusive parent to get supervised visits. And then the abuser, if he wants to have a normal relationship with the child, then what they'll need to do is, number one, go to like a battery ring program or something to, so that there's accountability. It's not that the program will teach them differently, but by holding him accountable, by penalizing him for his abuse, it sends a message that that behavior is not acceptable. Then the abuser would have to acknowledge that he was solely responsible for his behavior, that it was harmful to the children, that make a commitment not to do it again. And he will be told very clearly, you start using abusive tactics again, that's the end of your relationship. So the focus will be on what's best for the children instead of what's best for the abusive father.
How do you think the abusive father's been getting away with that? What's wrong with the court system there? Like, you know what I'm saying?
There are so many things wrong with the court system.
I know.
It really started, 35, 40 years ago, when domestic violence first became a public issue. There was no research available. And at the time, there were widespread assumptions that domestic violence was caused by mental illness, by substance abuse, by the actions of the victim. And so they responded by turning to mental health professionals as if they were the experts. And so we've now had a full generation plus of court professionals who have been hearing from psychologists and other professionals who are experts. But they're experts in mental illness. They're experts in psychology. They're not experts in domestic violence or child sexual abuse or other issues like that. And so we've gotten a lot of misinformation. And what tends to happen with inadequately trained professionals is they focus on the myth that women frequently make false allegations. They focus on phony, unscientific alienation theories. And they focus on the false belief that when a mother tries to protect the child from an abusive father, that she's hurting the child.
Say, Barry.
And so we've developed all these practices that are designed to pressure the mother to cooperate with her abuser instead of pressuring the abuser to stop his abuse.
Say, Barry.
And, there are just many standard mistaken practices that the courts have developed. And when we show them new research, when we complain about some really serious mistakes that they've made that have led to deaths of many children, they get very defensive and, they're not willing to be open to discussing the research and the results and doing better.
Yeah. Barry, I want to have a little debate here on the PAS, parental alienation syndrome. I know a lot of people out there are calling it junk science, but I think it's that's also a thin line, because I can remember when I was 8 years old, my parents got divorced, and then my mother got remarried when I was 10. But my father tried to poison me and my younger brother against my mother. He tried to get custody. He tried to manipulate us into wanting to be with him. He would say all kinds of nasty things. And, that to me just sounds like a classic PAS case there.
Let me say two different things about this. What you describe, I would call domestic violence by proxy. And it's a continuation of an abuser's efforts to control and hurt the mother by interfering with the relationship with the children. And as a matter of fact, there's very good research, including The Batterer's Parent, which is one of the leading books, that talks about all batterers engage in harmful practices that include undermining the relationship with the mother. So that's a typical thing. But what parental alienation syndrome really does, and lots of times they use that, but they call it alienation or parental alienation because it's so discredited. But what that does is it says if a child doesn't like the father, is afraid of the father, complains about the father, the only possible explanation is that the mother is alienating the child, and that what you need to do is separate the child from the mother and give custody to the dangerous father.
I see.
That's what parental alienation syndrome is. It doesn't leave room for the fact that lots of times children don't like their father because their father abused them or their mother or just was uninteresting or wasn't involved. And the basis of PAS is not any research. It was concocted by a man named Richard Gardner, who created the cottage industry of psychologists and lawyers that make a lot of money helping the worst abusive fathers, because those are the people that have most of the money in these contested cases. But this was not based on any research. It was based on his personal experiences, beliefs, and biases, which included many public statements to the effect that sex between adults and children is acceptable. I suspect that if judges knew the origin, they would not use it. Unfortunately, a lot of the times PAS got used, the mother's attorney didn't know the background and didn't challenge it sufficiently, so that this poison got into the court system and it's done an awful lot of harm to children.
Lawyers starting, or attorneys as you call them, in the US or America, starting to challenge the PAS, parental alienation syndrome? Are lawyers starting to use the fact that it's known to be junk science amongst psychologists in their defense? Or what's the sort of general amount of usage of the new evidence against parental alienation syndrome? How much is it being used in the courts now?
Well, there's one more factor. The DSM-5 recently came out, and that's the compendium of all valid mental health diagnoses. And the cottage industry and the abuser rights groups, you know, put tremendous pressure on the American Psychiatric Association to include PAS in their DSM, and they refused because there's no scientific basis for it. So there is really substantial reasons never use PAS. And what has happened in the courts
Barry,
in the U.S. Yes.
Gary, what, just for the uninitiated, what is DSM? DMS.
I'm trying to remember. It's diagnostic and I'm not remembering the letters, but this is like when you go to a mental health professional and you need to justify for the insurance company what your diagnosis is.
Yeah, you need a label for your diagnosis.
Right. It's like an encyclopedia or a compendium, as I said, of all valid mental health diagnoses.
So that's a very important point, isn't it? That it's not registered in, what is it? I don't even know the letters for it myself, but I know as soon as you say it what you mean by it.
Yeah,
it's the maybe it's the diagnostic manual for syndromes, I'm going to call it.
What has happened occasionally is that psychologists have been suspended or lose their license because when they diagnose PAS, they're diagnosing something that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
But what has happened in the courts is that because it's so discredited, they will use PAS, but they'll use it by another name, and they'll typically call it alienation or parental alienation. And we know that that's what they're using if they're asking for extreme remedies, which means the alleged abuser gets custody and the safe mother, who's usually the primary attachment figure, is limited to supervised visits. And they're just assuming that there's parental alienation based on the reaction of the child rather than actual evidence. And, you know, one of the real problems with the whole alienation theory is we're just throwing out that name. You know, you could go to court and you could say, well, the father or the mother said this or did that. And, you know, we could say, hey, that's not good behavior. You know, I have a case recently where the father was saying how lousy Arabs were and making up names about Arabs and all because the mother was one. You know, that's a really horrific kind of behavior. If I were to give an example of real alienation, that would be a good one. But we don't have to use a term like alienation, which has been so misused in the court. We can just describe what the father was doing or what a mother is doing rather than use these labels. And then we could make a more realistic determination of what do we do. I mean, say a mother who's a primary attachment figure says or does something that's not a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
But does that mean we want to separate a child from his primary attachment figure, which has very serious mental health consequences? Is that more important than if the father is abusing her? But what is tended to happen is we use the term alienation, not well defined, not understanding what the consequences are or aren't. We're just using that to trump domestic violence, which is a much more serious issue. And that's why the Safe Child Act, you know, demonstrates PAS is not a health or safety issue. Domestic violence is. It should be taken far more seriously. But routinely what happens in the courts is they'll treat the two things as equivalent and then pay far more attention to alienation theories that are, you know, not even well described and that are often misused.
Well, this is the thing that Judge Carlos Grzanski, who works for the United Nations, was saying, is that the people, the psychologists aren't trained well enough to understand parental alienation syndrome.
Neither are the judges either, or the court system.
Yeah.
Didn't he also say that too? Well, you said the psychologist, I thought.
Right, but it's the psychologists that are being used by the court too. Carlos Grzanski was saying that was one of the major things that needs happening is that psychologists, and sorry, you're right, Stephen, court psychologists or psychologists that are being used for the court and judges all need to be better trained in understanding some of these, exactly what Barry's explaining, parental alienation syndrome in particular. That is the crux of the matter, according to that particular judge. Yeah, go on.
I was in Washington last month and did like four presentations to the American Psychological Association National Conference. And I had the privilege of doing a presentation with three of the best psychologists probably in the world, Joy Silberg and Motrice Hanna and Julie Ansis. And what I found interesting is they are psychologists, but they're experts in domestic violence because they've spent thousands of hours getting trained, learning about the research, working with victims. So they are genuine experts. But what we're doing in the courts is we're taking psychologists who have no special background in domestic violence, and they'll get one or two workshops, and they'll have a few hours of training, which they may or may not have paid attention to, and they may disagree with, and we're treating them as if they're the experts. And that's how we keep getting these cases wrong. You know, what I think the research shows is that we need a multidisciplinary approach. There are cases where psychologists are needed when there's a valid mental health issue, something more than, oh, she's crazy. But if it's domestic violence, you need a domestic violence expert. If it's child sexual abuse, you need a sexual abuse expert. If it's substance abuse, you need that. If it's a medical issue, you need a medical doctor. You need to think about what is the expertise you need instead of what we've been doing for the past 35, 40 years, which just assumes that a psychologist must know all this, and then when they keep getting it wrong, you know, defending themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. That is the big thing. And even though all these things that you were just mentioning all sound very costly, what you're saying is the cost is far greater because what's happening is people are calling, you know, using a trump card, a false trump card. It's almost like you've got the fifth ace up your sleeve when you pull out parental alienation syndrome. So we want to explode that out of the water and blow that one up as being a valid way to argue, particularly when it's used, you know, someone say I'm a pedophile and you're my husband, and I say, oh, Barry's just trying to alienate me from the children, and I get away with it, and so I, the pedophile, get to have the kids, and then I abuse them, you know, and turn them into pedophiles, and it goes on and on and on and on and on. The costs, you know, the intergenerational abuse and all the side effects of that.
Right. And in addition to that, you know, what we have is the psychologists are using standard psychological tests that were not meant for the population seen in custody courts. And it doesn't tell us anything about their parenting. It certainly doesn't tell us anything about domestic violence. But a lot of these psychologists are assuming, well, if the father doesn't have an obvious mental illness, that he couldn't be abusing the children. But as we said before, mental illness is not the cause of domestic violence. It's their belief system. And so the psychologists aren't aware of even what to look for about domestic violence, so they keep denying true allegations of abuse, and then they want to punish the mother for raising their concern.
So what do we look for, Barry? Because, you know, just for people who aren't going to read the book but want to get the guts of the realization and then in the book and then use it in their conversation.
Well, the the essence of domestic violence are tactics that are used to coerce and intimidate their victim. So what we want to look at is the pattern of controlling and coercive behavior. So you look at psychological verbal abuse, you look at emotional abuse, financial abuse, litigation abuse, you look at isolation tactics, you look at monitoring type tactics. So, I mean, if someone is monitoring the phone of the victim, who is she calling, or checking her odometer, make sure she only drove to work and back, those are really strong indications that usually are easily proven. But what tends to happen is the courts only want to think about physical abuse, and they view it as he said, she said, in the one or two issues that are contested. And here they have all these other things that would help show his motive and the pattern that would make it easier for courts and professionals to recognize domestic violence, but they don't even know the significance of it.
That's really true. And that's on the basis, as you were saying, that it's that the abuser wants to control and coerce, which I find very pertinent at the moment in terms of a conversation Steve and I were having about somebody who supposedly had an aneurysm when their captive partner escaped from them. I heard about it through some woman somewhere. Sorry, I didn't hear about it from Stephen. I heard about it from somewhere else. Anyway, so it's the 30. You either get the 36 red roses or a car accident, or, you know, they do something to get attention. Would you like to talk a bit about how the bully does the sham victim routine?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
What I'm saying is, I think that's something that people need to recognize, even though, you know, I want to go back to, a more full sort of explanation of the solution in your book. But what we're talking about now is how we can recognize, here's the perfect example. You told me yesterday, Barry, of the guy who went to jail for sending a woman some flowers. You know, right. I'm talking about coercion and the courts recognizing signs of coercion. So sending someone flowers is a form of control and coercion in the hands of the right person.
Right, and that's important. It's the context. You know, if I appreciate the wonderful interview you did and I send you some flowers, that's not coercion. But if I just assaulted you and I want to make sure you don't leave or, file charges, and I sent you flowers, it's a whole different purpose. And, you know, we need to understand that.
Hey, Jill. Yeah. Jill, there's a question from the chat.
Oh, I'm not in chat. What's it say?
From one of the chats. No, she wants to know what about the funding. I'm sorry. What about where the funding is coming from the lack of the same resources for mothers? I guess she wants to know, is there going to be funding for mothers or why isn't there funding for mothers to try to help protect the children?
Well, in our sexist society, that has not been a priority, and it certainly needs to change. In the foreword for my book, Rita Smith wrote that this is what Rita Smith is the past executive director of the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And she said the Quincy solution is what the leaders of her movement have been looking for. Because this is the first time we have a realistic opportunity to dramatically reduce domestic violence, because of the component that has to do with the saving of money. That because we could save so much money by using best practices, that creates an incentive for prosecutors and police and the legislators to use, some limited resources in order to create benefits that are humongous. And so hopefully, if we can get the Quincy solution adopted in various communities, part of that will be to make sure that victims have more resources. And as I mentioned, one of the parts of the Quincy solution is making it easier for victims to leave, so that that would require giving victims resources, not only directly to themselves, but to have programs and other opportunities that make it easier for them to get away from dangerous abusers.
Now, look, just to give it a fair skew too, because there are a lot of women who are, this is why I propose myself to be the female pedophile in this conversation. There are a lot of, and I'm not, I know that men do tend to abuse, and will have a lot of physical power. There's not a lot of resources for men, like in terms of safe houses and, refuges. That we need to look into that too for when men are the victim in this situation.
Well, you know, Jillian, one of the chapters in my book, matter of fact, the second chapter, talks mm-hmm. about the difference between men and women, because mm-hmm. we have the tendency to create a false equivalence between yeah. men and women. They're not the same. There are thousands of years of history where husbands were allowed and encouraged to assault and control and discipline their wives. There's no equivalent history of wives having that right over their husbands. And so because of that history, domestic violence is overwhelmingly something that men do to women. And to try to create a false equivalency is a huge mistake. A lot of times, as a perfect example, the Ray Rice case, we saw the video. He punched her so severely and knocked her unconscious. And yet, initially, they charged both of them with crimes. Really absurd, but that's very common. You know, we said before that the main harm of domestic violence is the fear that it's engendered. And if Janae Rice were to slap Ray Rice, not that she should do that, and it's wrong, and I'm not going there, but he's not going to be afraid of her.
No.
He's not going to, you know, do whatever she wants because he's afraid she's going to beat her up. But the opposite is true. So to treat them as if they're the same is unfair as treating equal people differently.
But it's funny enough, though, and I know this is probably statistically correct, what you're saying. I just happen to be in a situation with some people that I'm very close to, and they're both abusive, and it's really difficult to say one or the other.
My turn next, Jill.
Pardon?
So my turn next.
Okay.
Go ahead. We're talking about some friends.
I've missed my thread anyway. David Schurter wants to come in.
I know he does, doesn't he? I'm not sure. I'm gonna find out. Hi, David.
Hi, David. Hey, what's up?
We're in the show right now.
Oh, very cool.
Can we talk later, or do you want to just
listen? Yeah, I'll sit and listen if you want.
Sure. That's fine. That's fine.
David is Barry. David Schurter has written a book called Rabbit Hole, and he was actually a victim of satanic abuse. He's a survivor, I should say, and an excellent survivor. And so he has a lot of experience of abuse at the hands of both men and women. But, bringing it back to what you were saying there's a false equivalence. So anyway, what can we set up? What can the government set up in your book? What ideas do you have to monitor those equivalences?
That's something I wanted to get to, Jill. There's a couple more comments in the chat there. Mm-hmm. Somebody wants to know about a class action Title IX suit, maybe. Do you know anything about that, Barry?
I don't know specifically. I know that periodically we've talked about doing a federal lawsuit, and unfortunately there's a lot of legal obstacles because custody and visitation and a lot of those issues are particularly reserved to the states. And there's an important case that I'm not remembering the name of that makes it really hard to go to federal court. Title IX might be a different situation because that's a federal civil rights law that might allow some assistance, but I don't know the specific case that they're referring to.
Okay. Well, I had another situation I wanted to run by you, Barry. It's been about 28 years ago. My stepbrother got custody of his little boy. And back then in the state of Michigan, it was almost unheard of that a man got custody of a child. But what he claimed in court was, I'm getting a bit of an echo here, but shown her to be a drug addict. And that's actually, in fact, what she was, because he was her supplier. He didn't happen to tell the judge that, but, you know, he didn't have any fund or anything like that. He paid for all of it out of his own drug money, and, he got custody.
Yeah.
The first thing we need to keep in mind is that some of these examples are unusual. I would tell you, however, that lots of times abusive men will give or even pressure their partners to take some drugs, and then if there's a separation or whatever, they use the fact that she was using it, even if they were using more, as a way to gain control. So, you know, there's so many different tactics that are used. What is important is to think about, are we talking about something that happens typically, or are we looking at something that is a rare occurrence? Unfortunately, you know, like in the case of custody, most cases mothers get custody, but that's done by consent, because usually the mother's done most of the child care, father loves the children and wants what's best for them, and so he sacrifices his interests for the best interests of his children, and he'll have normal relationship with them, and that's fine. The problem we're having in the custody court is the, you know, 3.8% of cases that go for trial and way beyond. These are overwhelmingly domestic violence cases. They're overwhelmingly the most dangerous abusive fathers. And in these cases, the fathers are winning most of the time. And that's a disaster for our children.
I think that's a very important point, Barry, because that is what we're dealing with in the court system. We're not talking about the general population. When people can't, just the fact that people end up in court trying to sort out custody is unusual.
Jill, we got just a couple of minutes left here, so we want to let Barry say again how he can be reached, or how somebody can get his book, and let him take it out.
Okay, we're really excited about the new book, The Quincy Solution, Stop Domestic Violence and Save $500 Billion. You can look at the Stop Abuse Campaign website or my website, BarryGoldstein.net. You can buy the book on the Stop Abuse Campaign website, but even more important, you can join the campaign. We have an opportunity to make our homes safe for women and children. It will change the society in so many wonderful ways, reducing common diseases, increasing our wealth, as I said, saving $500 billion a year in the United States. But most important, that our women and children can live their lives free from abuse.
Yes.
And so we need people to volunteer, to donate, to help make this a reality, because this is our opportunity.
Yes, it is. And I thank you for coming on once again, Barry Goldstein. And thank you also, Jillian, for coming on.
Oh, thank you, Barry. Thank you so much. It's ending sooner than we thought. Barry Goldstein.
Yes, it is.
Fabulous.
And thanks, everyone, at Revolution Radio, PSN Radio, and All Ireland Radio. I'll see everyone next week.